Thank you very much. I must say I have had the pleasure on several occasions of teaching books by Professor Arkes in class, including I once was stuck teaching an urban politics class because one of my colleagues was ill, and I used Hadley's Philosopher in the City for the first month of the class. But Hadley was very shocked one time when he discovered I had read his first book on the Marshall Plan. In any case, it's a real...
That book is used all over Chicago by my family as a poster.
In any case, it's a real pleasure to be here. As Hadley mentioned, my remarks arise out of the reflections that I had published last year on the 50th anniversary of what the French call le mai événement, the May events. And I'm going to draw on a published text, which is a reflection on the significance of 1968, not just for a Europe and European self-understanding, but for the West as a whole. I should add, May 68 was a big deal, or this anniversary, the 50th anniversary of May 68 was a big deal in France and Europe last year. Oddly enough, it was the 40th anniversary of the founding of the French Fifth Republic, the first durable, successful, self-respecting French constitutional order. There was absolutely no commemoration of de Gaulle and his political and constitutional achievement, and yet there was this sort of endless preoccupation with the social, cultural, and political significance of May 68. I think it will become clear from my remarks, 68 has a different meaning in the European context than in the American context. And to put it in a nutshell, I think it's not arbitrary to say that with the May of events, we saw the passing of an older Europe that was indebted to the sort of broader wellsprings of Western civilization to a new Europe that defines itself really as a kind of humanitarian or post-political democracy, one that is increasingly estranged from the traditional sources of Western civilization. And I hope that somewhat abstract formulation will become a little clearer to you. But look, what Europeans think about democracy, they don't think about democracy first and foremost as a project of democratic self-government. They don't think of it in terms of government as we would understand it. They think of it in terms of governance as a kind of project to actualize a conception of human rights, a conception of human autonomy, a conception of democratic values that in many ways entails moving away from and overcoming what is perceived to be the legacy of an older Western world. And we can contrast that, let's say, with the statesmanship of great 20th century European figures such as Winston Churchill and Charles de Gaulle in their different ways. If you look at their rhetoric during World War II, both of them defined the struggle between Nazi Germany and the sort of remnant of democratic Europe as a struggle. Understood what was at stake was the survival of what they both called the liberal and Christian West. In other words, they had some sense that modern democracy was indebted to, informed by, the larger civilizational tradition of the West. And I think increasingly Europe doesn't think of itself that way. It thinks of itself as having departed from that past and inaugurated on a new political adventure. Okay, in 1968, it seems to me, is the turning point, the decisive turning point. Now, in a recent visit to France, last May, I was there, so I sort of watched these commemorations up close. I was struck by, all the Parisian bookstores that prominently displayed a massive literature on the May events, magazines filled with nostalgic evocations of the 3 or 4 weeks that were said to have changed the world. Le Monde, which is the house journal of the French establishment left, went so far as to produce each day on the front page of the newspaper the parallel front cover from May 68, the good old days. Those old front pages perfectly captured both the obligatory leftism and the indulgence toward the young and the movement that dominated that venerable paper's response to the implosion of the French social and political order. One article by Maurice Duverger. Maurice Duverger was an old fascist who reinvented himself. He was a constitutional law scholar of some note in France, reinvented himself as a kind of bien-pensant leftist after the war. In any case, he was a sort of half-Stalinist fellow traveler in the 50s. That famous political scientist cheerfully seconded the student movement's calls for the abolition of exams, since examinations, A, they took professors away from precious scientific research, and at the same time reinforced the alienation of the young. So in this, in the giddy carnival-like atmosphere of the time, this passed for serious analysis. Now, we Americans sometimes forget that 1968 was a truly global phenomenon. We often attribute the unrest in our campuses, Columbia, Cornell, Berkeley, to the Vietnam War and to the reaction of the student movement, the peace movement, to the war. But in fact, there was no Vietnam War in Europe or in Africa or Tokyo. There was a global eruption of unrest in 1968 that was independent, I think, of the divisions occasioned by the Vietnam War at home. So that momentous year saw unrest in Dakar in Africa, Mexico City, Tokyo, and elsewhere. It saw the rise of a revolutionary new left throughout the Western world, and in a different key, the quasi-miraculous Prague Spring in Soviet-dominated Czechoslovakia. Now, there were both general and particular causes at work. 1968 surely had deep roots in cultural and social developments that were in the process of transforming the entire Western world. Some of you may remember the Second Vatican Council, 1962 to 1965. I remember that was supposed to let fresh air into the Catholic Church, the aggiornamento called for by Pope John Paul II. But the Catholic Church very quickly transformed itself from an authoritative bastion of traditional wisdom to a church which seemed to be in free fall. Its progressivist elements did not hesitate to kneel before the world, in the famous phrase of Jacques Maritain at the time, celebrating socialism and revolution, secular humanitarianism, and every ostensibly democratic development in society at large. In America, the moral promise of the civil rights movement, rooted in an appeal to the American principles of liberty and equality, bolstered, supported by biblical religion, were co-opted by the Black Power movement and other manifestations of identity politics. We just had Diana Schaub, wonderful political scientist, give a talk at Assumption about Lincoln and Frederick Douglass as part of the commemoration of the Lincoln Bicentennial. And Diana's theme was the estrangement of black intellectuals in the black community from Lincoln, which is really begins with Du Bois, but it took off. It was reinforced, and it gave rise to an absolute a consensus in the 1960s. So we see those transformations at work in the civil rights movement. The women's lib movement, as it used to be called way back when, and the recently manufactured birth control pill. It was, believe it or not, first manufactured in Worcester, Massachusetts, and was introduced in France in 1967. Seems to me they conspired, for better or worse, to sever sexuality from a natural order and individual liberty from some larger familial and social context. In France, social institutions as diverse as the church and the Boy Scouts scrambled to adopt less hierarchical power structures in the years immediately before 1968. My point is, the May events in France did not occur. They did not just come out of the blue, but there were profound social and cultural transformations at work in France and throughout the Western world. Everywhere, an ideology of liberation challenged the old bourgeois ethos of self-command and self-control. 1968, then, was in some important respects an explosion in a dramatic process that was already well underway, rather than the unanticipated announcement of a new world. Now, the next part of my paper, I'm going to talk a little more specifically about the May events in France. And then I'm going to move into a discussion of the significance of May 68, not only for European liberty, but for the self-understanding of the entire Western world. Despite these major social and cultural transformations, nothing in France seemed particularly out of the ordinary on the eve of May 68. In fact, I think it was the Nouvel Observateur published a cover a few weeks before the May events called "France is Bored with Itself." Remember, boredom as a factor in human history, a theme we were introduced to last evening. No one anticipated that ongoing disputes about the organization of the French university system would give rise to momentous social and political upheavals. Unrest at the University of Nanterre that had to do with cohabitation in the dorms, fueled by the activism of anarchist revolutionaries led by Daniel Combendi. I think Brett Stevens referred to him last night. Danny the Red soon spread to the Sorbonne. In the days after May 3rd, that august institution was more or less commandeered by student radicals. Students clashed with police, even as they and sympathetic professors contested, that to use the lingo of the day, the traditional structures of state and society. That means they didn't go to class, the students didn't go to class, and the teachers didn't teach, and they talked a lot and burned cars and set up barricades. They were contesting the power structures of an oppressive society. Student protesters combined violence with a festive atmosphere, celebrating their emancipation from traditional educational obligations and social and cultural restraints. In the face of this rapidly deteriorating situation, and I should add, initially French public opinion was remarkably indulgent toward the student revolutionaries, whom these were the sons and daughters of the bourgeoisie. They were the privileged elites, and their parents indulged them for a few brief weeks. And the government of Prime Minister, later President Pompidou, began to lose nerve. So the initial phase of the May event was followed by a nationwide general strike, a very French phenomenon, of up to 10 million workers. This really upped the ante. That lasted 2 weeks and shut down the economic life of the country. So this second economic phase of the crisis was followed by a political phase that lasted from May 27th until May 30. Begins as a carnival, it turns into a Leninist general strike, and then on May 27, the Communist Party decides to cross the Rubicon. The Communist Party decides to cross the Rubicon. After initial hesitations, so for the first time it looked like the strong, self-respecting constitutional order inaugurated by Charles de Gaulle in 1958 might collapse under the combined assaults of a student revolution, a general strike, and the machinations of leftist political forces. After initial hesitations and a quite lackluster television address on May 24th, nobody paid attention, President de Gaulle seized the initiative with a truly decisive radio address to the nation on May 30th, 1968. Remember, de Gaulle first came to the forefront on June 18, 1940, with his great appeal to the French nation broadcast over the BBC, and he resorted to the radio, an old-fashioned instrument of communication. He announced his decision to dissolve the National Assembly and to call for elections. He denounced what he called the intimidation, intoxication, and tyranny exercised by various revolutionary groups, as well as the danger posed by what he called a party which is a totalitarian enterprise. Those are the communists. He lamented the fact that as a result of this intimidation, teachers were prevented from teaching, students from studying, and workers from working. And he reassured the French people that the Republic will not abdicate. Hundreds of thousands of citizens responded to de Gaulle's radio address, by descending on the Champs-Élysées for a massive rally in support of the Republic. The tide had turned. The general strike began to run out of steam. It took another couple of weeks and three nights of the barricades. That means the radicals continued to burn cars and to hold out and to fight the police in order for order to be restored to the Sorbonne and the left bank. And in the elections at the end of June, the Gaullists for the first time won an absolute majority in the National Assembly. So things came full circle. Now, I think what's important to note, perhaps what's distinctive about the French situation was there were small groups of radicals, revolutionaries of the far, far left. There was a Trotskyite faction, a Maoist faction, and a Castroite faction. And you have to be privy to the sort of sociology of the totalitarian left to understand the differences among these factions. But they played a major role in radicalizing the student movement and directing many of these events I've spoken about. The subterranean revolutionary groupuscule, as they were called, outmaneuvered the Communist Party and claimed to speak for the young as a whole. Some of these militants are now quite famous people, André Glucksmann, Bernard-Henri Lévy, and the so-called new philosophers of media fame. They later broke with revolutionary ideology and sometimes became vocal defenders of the rights of man. The French term is soixante-huitard, 68ers, now tend to read their own intellectual and political trajectory into the nature of the event itself. They're now libertarians of the left, anti-totalitarians. So they say, well, 68, this was really a libertarian defense of dignity and freedom, a revolt against calcified authoritarian institutions, a revolt against the stuffiness of General de Gaulle and the repressions of the bourgeois university, on and on and on. Well, I think there's an element of bad faith and wishful thinking in this libertarian reading of 68. The libertarianism of 68 directed nearly all of its anti-authoritarian ire at bourgeois society and was remarkably indulgent toward the totalitarianism of the left. It's the same problem Bret Stephens raised last night about somebody like Naomi Wolf, how on the one hand she can be an advocate of limitless liberation at home while being indulgent toward various forms of repression abroad. It's an old syndrome, if I can put it that way. So the Marxist consensus so abundantly on display that year did not at the time reflect the slightest clarity about the real nature of communist totalitarianism. That was to come later under the impact of Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, a work that had a much more dramatic impact in France than anywhere else in the Western world. And I think it's fair to say that if a book has influenced the course of intellectual life, political history in the 20th century, it was, you know, Solzhenitsyn famously said about the Gulag Archipelago upon its publication, Burnham Wood is now moving. You know, the sense that the Soviet regime could not withstand that kind of assault on the ideological lie. But the French responded in a really dramatic way. Just a little thing regarding myself. My book on Solzhenitsyn just appeared in French translation in late August. It was something of a bestseller in the fall and winter. And the French have maintained this fidelity with Solzhenitsyn while Solzhenitsyn was dismissed by American elites. And, you know, his book on his American years is a bestseller in France and Germany, but is yet to find an American publisher. So those are those paradoxes of intellectual history. Okay, so in retrospect, it's easy to forget the massive abdication of good sense by many who ought to have known better during the course of the May events. The great exception was the French political philosopher, sociologist, and journalist, I'm going to shamelessly Americanize, Raymond Aron. I've written several books on Aron, and it's hard for an American to pronounce his name, Raymond Aron. So, but we don't say Alexis de Tocqueville, we say Alexis de Tocqueville, et cetera, et cetera. You know. Although, remember a few years ago with the Olympics, you know, the NBC broadcasters kept on saying Torino. No, we're Americans, we go to Turin. That's it. In any case, Raymond Aron. Raymond Aron, his columns in Le Figaro and his lively, eloquent, and insightful book, La Révolution Introuvable, The Elusive Revolution. They were beacons of clarity and civic courage in the midst of the revolutionary psychodrama, as Aron pointedly called it at the time. Aron was the first to expose the imitative character of students and intellectuals play-acting at revolution, risking the destruction of bourgeois society and the liberal university with little or nothing constructive to offer in their place. In his writings, he recalled Flaubert's and Tocqueville's powerful critiques of the Revolution of 1848. Flaubert's great novel, Sentimental Education, Tocqueville's great memoir of the Revolution of 1848, The Souvenir or Recollections, where a similar literary politics guided the pseudo-Jacobins of the time. And Aron highlighted this French propensity to make revolution in the place of a serious effort to bring about reforms. See, to bring about reforms involves mastering and practicing the political art. To play act at revolution has a special appeal to the intellectual come literary politician. A man of remarkably balanced judgment, Aron was angered by the inability and unwillingness of those in positions of responsibility to resist the delirium of the time. In The Elusive Revolution, he eloquently defends his refusal to take too seriously the various actors in the revolutionary comedy. And I quote, I'm going to quote these because they're good quotes. It's a wonderful book. "I refuse to salute our admirable youth. Too many grown men have done so. Barricades, which are symbolically effective, seem to me neither an intellectual nor a moral achievement. If young people have exalted memory of the barricades, well and good. Why should old people be obliged to counterfeit sentiments which they do not feel? If the young denounce the brutality of the French police while in the same breath preaching the cult of violence, limitless violence themselves, the contradiction seems to be nothing more than a good technique of subversion. But men of my generation or of the generation after do not want to feel that they were caught up in what I persist in calling collective madness. They do not accept that they are out of their minds." Remember John Leonard's review in the New York Times of the American edition of The Elusive Revolution, and he grudgingly admitted that there was much wisdom to Aron's critique of 68. He said, "But he's like a man who comes to the orgy and stays sober." You know. Well, Leonard didn't want to hear this. Aron had long been a critic of the over-centralized and overcrowded French university system, and had even left the Sorbonne in disgust, as he put it, some months before May 68. And while he respected General de Gaulle as an authentically great man, he also freely acknowledged the limits of Gaullist hauteur, the quasi-monarchical style that had set the tone for the French Fifth Republic. He was also critical of the civil service authoritarianism of the Fifth Republic's governing class and of the quasi-neutralist bent of French foreign policy. By the way, when I talk about the quasi, I don't share the sort of Francophobia of many on the American right. I remember, for example, that we were almost wholly in the wrong during World War II, where Roosevelt continued to maintain diplomatic relations with Vichy and did everything. We didn't recognize the Free French as the legal government of France until November 644, 4 months after the De Gaulle was in Paris. And of course, De Gaulle was really the only obstacle to a communist takeover of France. So America has its faults and its responsibilities in our bilateral dance with France. And I would add that in the big issues like Berlin, the three Berlin crises from 58 to 61, de Gaulle was very tough. He wanted to tear down the Berlin Wall. When President Kennedy sent Dean Acheson to Paris with the photos of the Soviet missiles in Cuba, De Gaulle said that, he said, I don't need to see them. The word of the American president is good enough for me. And when the Soviet ambassador harangued De Gaulle at the time, saying, you know, we can destroy France with nuclear weapons, De Gaulle said, well, we have nuclear weapons too, and Mr. Ambassador, we shall perish together. So there's that side of De Gaulle. But I would say the quasi-neutralism took the form of support for the West in all the big crises and being a pain in the neck and independent the rest of the time. And there were problems with that foreign policy, as Aron highlighted. But I would also add, the French never developed a peace movement, a disarmament movement in the early 80s. There were no political pressures to disarm. When President Mitterrand blew up the Rainbow Warrior, the Greenpeace boat in New Zealand, there was no investigation in Parliament. There was a consensus on the right of left that these guys were pains in the neck, and this is what a self-respecting state does. So that's the other side of France. I'm not advocating blowing up Greenpeace boats, by the way. It's not a good idea. Hadley thinks I've gone soft. So in Aron's view, the Fifth Republic was a liberal order, with a tinge of authoritarianism about it that respected fundamental political and personal liberties. There's a wonderful line in The Elusive Revolution where Aron says, I'm deeply wounded by 1968's, what he called its radical negation of patriotism, and by the substitution of the name of Che Guevara for that of an authentic resistance hero and statesman such as Charles de Gaulle. Yes. It pains me, by the way, that a totalitarian butcher like Che Guevara has become the object of veneration among the young, but that's a long story for another occasion. Unfortunately, Aron's voice was largely absent from the French commemoration of the May events. The relative absence of Aron's perspective in the contemporary debate is problematic for several reasons. Aron's writings in 68 serve as a powerful corrective to the ongoing French tendency to become obsessed by their memories or the myths of their past, and as Aron put it, to mistake riots and disorder in the streets of Paris for a Promethean exploit. In addition, Aron's writings on 68 make abundantly clear what was at stake in the final revolutionary days of May before de Gaulle's May 30th radio address awoke the good sense of France's silent majority. Just to summarize, say this as succinctly as possible, I think contrary to the contemporary legend that this was simply, as many French commentators, they tend to over-theorize everything. They say 68 was an eruption of the social, which means of social passion, of civil society against an authoritarian state. The whole totalitarian impulse, the urge to destroy a liberal state and society in the name of some abstract future, all of that sort of covered over in the new consensus about 68. I was quite struck recently. I read a memoir of 68 by the great French historian Alain Besançon called Souvenir de Mai 68, and he speaks about how the days before the May 30th address, he and Henri Criegel, an old French Stalinist who became a great authority in the French Communist Party and one of France's smartest and most determined anti-communists, and Aron sat around Besançon's table and agreed that if the communists came to power in the next day or two, they would go into exile. And they were prepared to leave the country in a day or two. So really, when I talk about how close France came between May 27th and May 30th of succumbing to a totalitarian dictatorship, I'm not being hyperbolic, you know. And so again, the sort of romanticization of the event, I think, overlooks just what was immediately at stake in May 68. Besançon at the same time has perceptively noted the yawning gap between the heady language in which the actors of 68 expressed themselves and the uniformity of that event's consequences. Understanding that gap is crucial to deciphering the mystery of 68. You look at these remarkably juvenile slogans that were chanted by the revolutionaries in the streets. They're fun, so I'm going to read some of them, remind you of some of them. Demand the impossible. My favorite. It is forbidden to forbid. Take your dreams for realities. In themselves, these are without any serious intellectual interest or content. They are, however, deeply revealing popular expressions of a deep-seated, I'm going to use a fancy word, antinomianism connected to the thought underlying 1968. Antinomianism means of hostility to law or convention, of course. But I think the spirit of the New Left was antinomian. And a hatred of law, convention, custom, wisdom, prudence, this libertarian impulse is perfectly compatible with an indulgence toward totalitarianism. To the extent that the movement had a coherent ideological profile, it can be found in the conjunction of the philosophy current in France in the 1960s. Structuralism, Byzantine and obscure as it was, with a diffuse leftist ideology that paid homage to Mao, Trotsky, and Castro. By the way, there's still Trotskyites in France. I just published an article in the French magazine Commentaire called Réponse à un historien trotskyiste. My book was denounced in the Quinzaine Littéraire, the French version of the New York Review of Books, by France's leading Trotskyite historian. Very odd. Very odd. They're still around. This ideology had its hardcore in the revolutionary groupuscules mentioned above, which played a major role in radicalizing events in both the universities and factories. The ideology's soft core was this anti-authoritarian, anti-hierarchical, antinomian approach that might broadly be called left libertarian. So these partisans of 68 were mesmerized by direct democracy, democracy in the streets, by participation in the factories, by the democratization of the university, by, in effect, by an assault on authority in all authoritative, cultural, social, and educational institutions. In a famous book that has given rise to endless polemics, The Pensée de 68, The Thought of 68, the French philosophers Luc Ferry and Alain Renaud analyzed the thought of 68, the anti-humanist philosophical currents that preceded, informed, and were given life by the revolutionary spectacle of that year. I should say, these are all the intellectual currents that dominate in the teaching of the humanities in American universities today. Some of Ferry and Renaud's critics have vociferously denied that thinkers such as Foucault, Derrida, Lacan, and others had much of a causal role in the May events. Their writings were too abstract, they say, to influence a broader public, and some of them, Foucault in particular, were at least initially skeptical of the students and their motives. But all of this is beside the point. Ferry and Renaud did not claim that anti-humanism or sophisticated Parisian nihilism caused the May events. They made the more limited and much more plausible claim that the French philosophy of the 60s created an atmosphere that nourished the spirit of 68 and informed the action of many of its key players. By the way, one of the fashionable ideas at the time was Jean-Paul Sartre had written a book in the early 60s called The Critique of Dialectical Reason. Its opening line in the chapter, A Search for Method, is, Marxism is the unsurpassable philosophy of our time. Right? We now know that Sartre wrote that book on barbiturates. 13 hours a day in a drug-filled haze, he tried to synthesize Marxism and existentialism. But the most memorable moment in that book is this comparison of the group, the serial group, anonymous individuals in a bourgeois society, cut off from each other. Like he says, a group of people waiting for a bus. That's a serial group. And then the true community that comes to the forefront through fraternity terror, brotherhood in terror, the crowd storming the Bastille, etc. The revolutionaries took to this idea of fraternity terror, overcoming the anonymity, the alienation of the liberal order. So there are all these currents at work. One of the defining traits of the New Left everywhere was its conflation of liberty with liberation and its willful refusal. By the way, one of the great French newspapers that arose out of May 68 was Libération. And its willful refusal to distinguish authority from authoritarianism. This isn't just a French disease. Nor was this a passing phase. In the years after the May events, as Roger Kimball and Roger Scruton, among others, have documented, the thought of 68 became the official philosophy of the humanities in universities throughout the Western world. The scientism of the structuralists gave way to radical social constructivism and intemperate efforts to subvert, to deconstruct, as everyone says today, traditional wisdom and established social institutions. Egalitarian moralism coexisted with a fanatical repudiation of the idea of truth, with a dogmatic insistence that morality and justice have no other supports than the linguistic categories and cultural assumptions of a contingent social order. The academic partisans of deconstruction give no more thought than their forebears in France to the effects of such easygoing nihilism on the capacity of free men and women to live together in a spirit of responsibility and mutual respect. Without some sort of grounding, equality and justice become will-o-wisps, ideological slogans to express contempt for reality that does not live up to the languid dreams of intellectuals. Is there anything good to be said about May 68 and its consequences? Well, some people have made the argument, I think there's a little bit of truth to that, that the democratization of mores, the weakening of heavy-handed paternal authority in the family, church, and political order, growing demands for genuine consultation between employers and employees, rulers and rule, that to some extent these demands did serve to revitalize the democratic energies of modern societies. I would say these developments, legitimate within limits as a corrective to the rigidities of a traditional social order, were well underway before 68. With the explosions of May, they took on a strikingly destructive or nihilistic cast. They gave rise to a new political correctness, a new authoritarianism that was far more illiberal than anything found in the old order, since it showed limitless contempt for the habits, practices, and judgments that had long served to support civilized human existence. And I'm just going to end on a note. A recent article called Relativism, written by Dominique Schnapper, a French sociologist who's also Raymond Aron's daughter. She's on the French Supreme Court. You don't have to be a lawyer to be on the French Supreme Court. Maybe it would be good if we had political scientists like Hadley on the Supreme Court. And it's not going to happen. In any case, Dominique Schnapper has argued that May 68 was informed by and has given rise to what she calls a relativistic philosophy of, the French word is indistinction, loosely, it's not a word in English, a philosophy of indistinction. I just want to follow this argument for a minute, and I'll end at this note, on this note. And again, the context is, is a reflection on the multiple ways in which 68 gave rise to a systematic assault on all those authoritative institutions that were necessary to sustain a free and civilized human order. Okay, so back to Schnapper. She writes, I think, very suggestively about this philosophy of indistinction that has become widespread in the Western democratic world. The democratic principle of human and civic equality, right? The kind of moral and civic understanding of equality upheld by Lincoln or the founders, has been radicalized, as Tocqueville predicted, into a passion for equality that perceives every distinction as discriminatory, every difference as inegalitarian, every inequality as inequitable. The relations between civic equals which lies at the heart of democratic life, becomes the unchallenged model for all human relations. Moreover, a laudable respect for the accomplishments of different cultures has given way to an absolute relativism that denies the very idea of universal moral judgments and universal human nature. Such extreme equality, as Montesquieu already called it in Book 8 of The Spirit of the Laws, is a corruption of democracy. And it lurked at the heart of this democratic eruption that characterized May 68. And by the way, if you take Schnapper's analysis, you'd say marriage, an institution integral to a human order, integral to a free order that serves multiple human political moral goals. The philosophy of indistinction transforms marriage as traditionally understood into an oppressive and inegalitarian institution that has to be, you know, there's as the analytic philosophers say, there's a category mistake at work here, you know, because you try to introduce an understanding of equality into the nature of marriage itself that deforms the very nature of marriage. And part of the democratic art, part of the political art, is an ability to make distinctions, the kinds of civilized distinctions that are necessary to preserve a free political order. And my suggestion is that what May 68 represented was a kind of decisive critique of that capacity to make the requisite distinctions. I'll end on that note. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
Disrupted the previous order of things. One, of course, was the Vietnam War and the protests against the Vietnam War, which had certainly justifiable reasoning. And the second was also the Civil Rights Revolution and the death of Martin Luther King and the uproar that surrounded all that. So this country itself was in a state, certainly, I guess, perhaps the most polite word would be upheaval, you know, at the time. And I recall at the time regarding the French events that you described as really not so much things that were peculiar to the French, but as simply a contagion of what was going on here, that young people in France simply saw the the uproar as the disorder caused by the Vietnam War protests, which had moral justification to some extent, the civil rights upheaval, the death of Martin Luther King, which certainly had moral justification. And they said, we like all of this sort of disorder. It's great fun to go out and raise hell and so forth. A lot of the Vietnam War protesters, I think, did so more to...
Edward Banfield called it in his book, The Unheavenly City, rioting for fun and profit.
Well, I mean, there was that element to it, and I regarded the French upheaval as really sort of a contagion of...
Yeah, well, you raise... You,
and not peculiarly French.
You raise an interesting question about the mimetic or imitative character of student unrest, of revolutionary violence. There's something to that, although I think I made the case that the French, the 68 was a global phenomenon that reflected, I think, less, perhaps America's involvement in Vietnam was a catalyst, certainly the catalyst at home, along with other events related to race in the United States. I'll get to all that in a second. But and clearly the radical left in Europe was motivated by, informed by a deep disdain of what they saw as American imperialism, American oppression. One of the notable facts about the revolutionary left in France in May 68, it totally lost any interest in the Soviet Union. Brezhnev and the Politburo, these were sclerotic old men in suits, you know. They turned to more exotic manifestations of totalitarian socialism in Cuba and China and Vietnam. But I don't think it was primarily an imitation or response to events in America. It was coextensive with them. It was informed by social and cultural events that were very deep-seated, transformations that were very deep-seated in France. That's why I mentioned the transformations in the church, even the Boy Scouts, the change in sexual relations, etc. So, yes, it was a contributing factor, the American unrest, the American debate about Vietnam. I don't deny that there was an element of imitation, but I don't think it's the primary explanation. About the peace movement, about the moral claim of the peace movement, the problem with the peace movement, of course, is it went way beyond a prudential or even seriously moral argument about the legitimacy of American involvement in Vietnam. The peace movement established as a dogma that the only legitimate, the only moral way for the United States to extricate itself from Vietnam was to withdraw immediately, to essentially abandon the people and government of the Republic of Vietnam, to establish a neutralist coalition government would pave the way for the communist domination of the whole of Vietnam. And I think in retrospect, that was not a very moral project. I think of my life, the most shame I felt as an American was watching those helicopters take our friends and allies off the roofs of buildings in Saigon in April 1975. And to think after the North Vietnamese agreed to a peace treaty, after the United States pledged itself in a solemn treaty to defend the Republic of Vietnam, to provide aid, one-for-one, arms replacement, etc., and Congress between 73 and February 75 simply cuts off all aid, reduces it, and then eventually cuts off all aid for Cambodia and Vietnam. So the peace movement, yes, there were some legitimate moral impulses at work, but I think in the end the peace movement in its own way succumbed to a kind of nihilism. The race question is interesting, I think, and important because just as the United States was delivering on that promissory note that Martin Luther King spoke about in his great speech at the Mall in Washington in November 1963, the I Have a Dream speech, just as the principles of Lincoln and the founding are being actualized in practice, the civil rights movement or wing of the civil rights movement abandons those principles. I mentioned in my talk, parenthetically, the growing estrangement from the great emancipator Lincoln. It's really quite a remarkable phenomena. So, and again, I think, like the anti-war movement, there are moral impulses at work, but moral impulses that are distorted beyond recognition. And so what begins as an affirmation of the moral principles at the heart of this regime, what begins as a civic call and a biblical call to justice, ends up succumbing to the, you know, absurdities of the Black Power movement, etc. So I think all of those things were going on. But just back to your first point, I don't think France was a sideshow. I don't think it was just sort of a reflection of generalized contagion from the American example. I think it was an independent but complementary display of the same social phenomenon.
What would you say has been the enduring impact of the of 68 on the French right?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, Sarkozy got himself in some trouble during the presidential campaign 2 years ago by giving a big speech in a sports stadium a week or two before the first round of the presidential and attacked 68. He said 68 had introduced delirium, disorder, an assault on the Republic. And Sarkozy was roundly criticized, even by some of his supporters, for not appreciating the social achievements of 68. So I would say many people on the center-right have bought into this semi-mythological, semi-romantic account of the legacy of 68. Many others, however, remain I think, sympathetic to the kind of critique proffered by an Iron. So I think there's a divide there. But to come back to my first remarks about how May 68 set in motion not only social and cultural transformation, but, you know, a kind of softening of European democracy. You know, gave rise to the sort of new humanitarian post-political democracy. I think the center-right parties participate in that current, too. So you can't imagine a De Gaulle in France today, you know, because it's De Gaulle is so at odds with the spirit of late modernity. You can't imagine someone today speaking with the directness that Aron spoke about. Aron's reaction to May 68 reminds me of a line in Aristotle's Ethics where he says, it's legitimate to be angry in the right manner at the right time. You know, Aron was angered in his very equitable, humane way by this eruption of madness, right? But I don't think in the center-right, even in France today, that's the dominant response. The center-right, too, has sort of bought into a soft version of 68.
You make the point really aptly that I don't think you're right that the leftist ethos that now dominates in the humanities and social sciences and the American academy, this was really came right out of that.
Right out of France.
Right
out
with the whole postmodernism, deconstruction.
Right.
That is the American orthodoxy now.
Well, that's right. And for a long time, for about 30 years after May 68, all of the interesting French currents in political philosophy, people like Marcel Gauchet, Luc Ferry, Pierre Menon, were not published in America because there was a revival of political philosophy in France in the mid-70s, partly inspired by Solzhenitsyn, partly by the discovery of people like Strauss, partly by students of Aron. American academic publishers were simply uninterested in translating these guys. They were non-Marxist. They were non-postmodernist. They were deeply rooted in classical philosophy, etc. And this all seems somehow not in accord.
It's not French.
And Derrida ended his life teaching at the University of California, Riverside, where he had students, Californian students.
Well, we then made incomprehensible.
My question is actually kind of a follow-up on the first question. And I was in school in those days, and what struck me is that from the U.S. perspective, everything going on over in France, we were aware of it, but only tangentially, so if we were kind of mainstream kids. But I think that there was the organizing element behind the radical, let's call it radical student movement in the U.S., the Weather Underground.
Mm-hmm,
There was a suspicion, there has been a suspicion for a long time, that there was a lot more behind the organization of the leadership than met the eye on the surface. And that maybe behind it all was, in some views, a KGB-type plot, that certainly the Soviet state had a stake in how this played out. It was undermining it. It undermined the Western allies. It undermined the Western military objectives and political objectives in Southeast Asia, and it served their interests. Now that doesn't mean that there was that. Is there any? Have you come across, or is there any evidence for that kind of involvement?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Look, we know from the Soviet archives, the wonderful volume, Vladimir Bukovsky, the great Soviet dissident, went back with a scanning machine to Moscow in 1991-92 when the archives were completely open and scanned everything he could find, found massive evidence of Soviet support for Western communist parties. Gus Hall got $100,000 a year. Poor Gus Hall from Minnesota, the loser American communist perennial candidate for president, $100,000 a year, every year from like 1942 from the Soviet Union. And Marché, all the Eurocommunists got money from the Politburo, from the KGB. There was massive financing of the peace movements in Europe in 80, 81, 82, 83. So we know that. The Soviets actually did not, they were taken by surprise by May 68 because they were quite pleased with de Gaulle's independent foreign policy. They liked some of the rifts that an independent French foreign policy had introduced into the alliance. And they were a little wary of the French Communist Party taking the next step, you know, crossing the revolutionary Rubicon, as I put it. In this country, too, I think there were some there were, you know, when I compared the situation in France with those revolutionary groupuscules with America. No, there were, we had our radical ideologues, our Maoists, our Trotskyites, and you're quite right to associate them with the left wing of the SDS and with the, some elements in the peace movement and with the Weather Underground. I don't think this was KGB manipulated. I mean, I think these impulses were domestic in character. But I think the peace movement is another matter altogether. I think I'm much more familiar with the evidence regarding Soviet support for the West European peace movements in the early 80s. So I think it's very, very important to calibrate these things, and I don't know of any evidence that of any real Soviet support and Soviet involvement for new left organizations in the late 60s.
Let me take it from another angle.
Yeah.
Of something you had said. This couldn't explain what was going on at Amherst, for example. I think it Will, and, let's see, and I were, I think Will was at Columbia. I hear when there's a cluster of us, in young professors in their late 20s, who couldn't understand how the senior people just caved in. They seemed to lose their nerve.
I think that's right.
And what seemed, either they couldn't stand up against this, we find at Amherst, they forced the president of the United States, president of the college, a grown-up, to address a letter to Nixon in the accents of an adolescent. And wondering what happened to the senior faculty here? Have they lost their lost their capacity to explain with conviction a liberal order?
Yeah. You remember the title of Mitch Dechter's book from the mid-70s, Liberal Parents and Radical Children. But, I mean, Sidney Hook was preoccupied with this issue. What happened to American liberalism? Why did the liberals find it impossible to defend the civilities and the forms, both in politics and in university life, attendant to a liberal order? Where were the voices, the Arones, in America? There were some, like a Hook. But they were comparatively rare. The liberals were people who couldn't articulate or defend liberty. They had their tails between their legs. And I think what the 60s really did reveal was the thinness of a liberalism that could no longer articulate its own purposes.
As Dan Robinson said, education is something we do around here until something better comes along.
Yeah, well right. said. Well said.
Right.
Well
right.
said.
So because we called off classes in 69 and call them off again in Cambodia. Oh, sure, we do that. You know, we don't want business as usual, as though there's something lesser about this business. Ryan?
I guess to ask Midge Dechter's question in the French context, sort of what happened? Because the story of May 68, as you tell it, has somewhat of a happy ending. I mean, de Gaulle gets on the radio and he affirms that the Republic will not be abdicated.
Because there was a grown-up there.
Right, exactly. And there were rallies in support of the Republic and order is restored. And then I guess sort of my question is, what accounts for the intellectual entrenchment among such a large segment of the population of the ideological undercurrents of May 68? Is it merely that youthful generation grew up and became the dominant demographic cohort, or is there some other kind of social or political transformative event that accounts for it?
Well, the French case, I mean, I spent some time speaking about the French philosophy of the 60s, which is now the official philosophy of the American humanity departments. So it was the ideas, the ideologies of the fathers that informed and reinforced that event. So they're wholly complicit. The demographic trend is important. The domination of the media by people who are nostalgic for those events. The self-justifications of people who want to know better but try to justify their Maoist past by saying secretly, dialectically, we were contributing to a new anti-totalitarian consensus. All of that came together in France. But I one's tempted to say in a bigger way, it's the death of God. It's the de-Christianization of the West. It's the, if the West was a civilization based on the twin pillars of reason and revelation, if the West was a civilization, as Churchill and de Gaulle said in their Great War speeches, you know, where Christian ethics and a liberal political order were allies in a deep and fundamental way against totalitarian nihilism, seems to me that understanding of the traditional strengths, the pillars, the nature of the West, it was fraying and fraying for a long time. And, 68 in the French context was more or less the coup de grace. But I think you need a sort of deeper... you know, you need a deeper look in the European case at a civilization that has lost self-confidence and a lost under. So you have to understand for the French, for a certain kind of European today, Europe began in 68. They're not really interested in the West. The idea of the West, which is still meaningful to people like ourselves in this context, is not a meaning. The West is an essentially guilty. I mean, this nonsense that somehow it's the traditional sources of the West, biblical religion, liberalism, bourgeois society, that all came together in the Holocaust, you know? The Nazism, of course, was a virulently anti-Christian and anti-liberal, you know, paganism, you know, a nihilism. But the sort of official civil religion of Europe today says the Holocaust revealed the true nature of the West, you know?
Set something up for you beautifully, but I should kind of. You know, Steve did his thesis on events. Did you do French politics? Do you have any angle on this, Steve?
He certainly wasn't what?
Not understood.
Yes.
The thing, see, what this you made me recall, this made me recall, was I think the most, for me, the most riveting part of de Gaulle's memoir, when they were, because Renault was prime minister, they're chased mm-hmm. out of Paris, they're in the countryside, and Weygand, who was always the defeatist, mm-hmm. said it's time to open up discussions with the Germans about an armistice, and de Gaulle pipes up and says, what he says, he's an aide to Renault, he says, I have another idea. Weygand said, you have an idea, you have a proposition to offer? And de Gaulle says, nous n'avons de proposition, stuff. We don't have propositions to offer, we have orders to give. Mm-hmm. We're in charge. If they push us out of Paris, we're in the countryside. If they push us out of the country, we're in North Africa. If they push us out of North Africa, we're in Canada. This doesn't come to an end unless we're ready to accept that regime. And you say, not only was a grown-up missing, but you remind ourselves, what was the depth of daring and courage and conviction that came along with being a grown-up?
De Gaulle was the only person in the French military and political hierarchy who was able to put the Battle of France in a larger frame of time and space. He articulates it very nicely in the appeal of June 18. This is a moment. It's a defeat, but it's an episode in a larger struggle that goes on, and France must be part of the struggle. You know, he writes to Roosevelt on October 26, 1942, right on the eve of Operation Torch and the invasion of North Africa, and he says, look, America's making a terrible mistake continuing the Vichy option. He said, some in your administration are suspicious of what we represent, but he said, we are trying to sustain the cause of French greatness and liberty, and we are the only alternative to the totalitarian enterprise. Right. The Roosevelt administration never appreciated what de Gaulle represented. You know, Roosevelt always thought he was, you know, he thought he was Joan of Arc. He's an egomaniac. Churchill comments in the fourth volume of the History of the Second World War. Well, he was sort of Joan of Arc. He was a great, you know, that image meant something to Churchill as much as de Gaulle could annoy him, you know, the prickliness of de Gaulle. But for Roosevelt, Roosevelt was always much more worried about de Gaulle, the aspiring tyrant, than he was about a Vichy option, than he was about a communist takeover of France. It's all quite startling.
See, Pete had one, we're going to close, but let's repeat the last question.
Yeah, so as I hear the story, they lost, but they won. I mean, they did their little game, they made fools of themselves, then the communists tried to take advantage of it and take over the country, and then they were decisively repudiated by the general public. But as an intellectual matter, they went off and somehow they won.
They not only won in terms of the soft version of the May 68 ideology, mm-hmm. the antinomian version becoming the civil religion of France and Europe, they won in terms of the definition and recollection of the event itself. The Fifth Republic survived, of course.
The Republic survived, but I mean, in terms of the West, is the West going to survive? Is this an indication? Are we in some kind of fundamental long-term decline now where we seen to, you know, the masses are not on board for this, just like they
were. You know, last time Hadley invited me to Amherst, I gave a talk on the crisis of contemporary Europe. And afterwards, a very nice young Amherst student said to me, you know, something you said reminds me of Zizek. And this sort of, my back stiffened a look. Zizek is one of those figures you only read on university campuses. He's the only East European who's read in places like Amherst today. Zizek is a Slovenian Leninist, a self-declared disciple of Lacan, the structuralist Freudian, and a Leninist. His last book, you can go down to the Amherst bookstores, In Defense of Lost Causes, has a long chapter in defense of historical materialism, Marx and Lenin, a retrospective defense of Red Terror under Lenin and Stalin, a celebration of Mao, etc., etc., all under the guise of an attack on some neoconservative ideology that has forced us to forget the historical achievement of the socialist movement. I mention this only because, and my reaction at the time, trying to be as restrained as possible, was it's a bit of a scandal that young people at an institution like Amherst do not read Shewa Miłosz, do not read Alexander Solzhenitsyn, do not know of these figures, but they're exposed to the fraudulence of this Slovenian Leninist Maoist structuralist, who is a kind of parody, an East European parody of May 68 ideology. And believe me, no one else is reading Zizek, but a generation of young people are exposed to this stuff, and it's disturbing. It's disturbing in pretty important ways.
This is, by the way, here's the book on Solzhenitsyn, available on Amazon.
It is available on Amazon.
Right. And
I should say I'm more proud of the Solzhenitsyn Reader, New and Essential Writings, 1947 and 2005, which is a commented anthology of Solzhenitsyn's writings, and about 35% of the volume is new in English. It just came out in paperback. It's available for $14, 700 pages on Amazon.
But I think the best thing I can say, the most apt thing I can say in closing this session is, I think you see what I mean about that, and I think this would be an altogether better place if I could have him here with me.
Thank you, Hadley.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Thank you very much.